This is Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, unpopular opinion time, the dragon's hot take on speculative fiction issues.
This week is fueled by rage.
No, not entirely. there will be a little bit of rage, possibly. But rage is one of those things that kind of feeds itself, isn't it? So we'll see. I will try and keep my I will try and keep things within normal parameters and not fire too hot. But basically, this is some of the speculative fiction opinions and things which are very common. And either we don't agree or one of us doesn't agree. And we may well end up disagreeing with each other, but we are adults and we're going to do it amicably to prove that you can.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah.
In theory, it's a lighter episode.
Yes. So, Jules, I believe that you have quite an extensive list. So why don't you start off, because I'm absolutely sure that there are going to be a lot of things on that list which I'm going to be jumping in on as well very, very quickly. So why don't you start us off and get the ball rolling?
The fact that I have an extensive list makes it sound like I'm one of those grumpy old women who's sort of just like, you probably don't remember Dear Points of View, but Dear Points of View! wants to complain about
like
niche
that.
Shit stuff. but no, it's true. Once I'd started writing it down a few things that I was just kind of like, hey, this is annoying. This is bugging me. Obviously, I managed to collect a few more. So I've got some which are big things and some which are very small, teeny, personal things. But it's just kind of like I go against the grain on these things. So the first thing, yeah. I suppose, is this is one where, depending on your viewpoint, you might completely disagree with me, and that's fine. I'm wired up this way, so this is what I think on this issue. And that is that with all pieces of speculative fiction, nuance is important, which means that you should be looking at the context. If you're doing, say, for example, a book to film adaptation, then when that book was written and why it was written the way it was, and having an understanding of the text is important, even if you decide to go in a completely different direction. So, what do I mean by this, basically? I'm going to take Pride and Prejudice as an example. I know it's not really speculative, even though it's the closest Jane Austen gets to writing an actual fairy tale. It's basically a Beauty and the Beast retelling. But, you know, the BBC Pride and Prejudice with Colin Firth and Jennifer Ely actually skips a lot of the important nuance in the book, but it's really true to the source material's spirit and what it's trying to portray in terms of characterization.
Yeah.
So, you know, while it misses a lot of nuance and, you know, it takes things out, it's still true to what the actual story was trying to tell. And in fairness, I have seen retellings, for example, Lost in Austin is a brilliant piece of satire, which is true to what Jane Austen was originally saying and what she might say now to a modern audience, but obviously pokes some tongue-in-cheek fun at Pride and Prejudice and does it really well. And, you know, both of those things are totally valid versions of the book. And, you know, I'm not a big fan of the Keira Knightley film version of Pride and Prejudice. For one thing, there's not enough space. There is not enough space to tell a highly nuanced, intelligent story, which is about deconstructing class and deconstructing the war between England and France, which is what Pride and Prejudice does, and unpacking the entire fairy tale mythos, which is what Pride and Prejudice does. And I get that it's some people's favourite version, and they think that it is Matthew McFadden, isn't it?
It is Matthew McFadden.
Yeah, and Keira Knightley, just that's their Darcy and Elizabeth, and that's fine. And there's beautiful scenery and the music is exquisite, but it doesn't tell Pride and Prejudice. It just doesn't. And I get a little bit annoyed, I suppose, when people tell me that I'm being redundant and sort of not very modern in my thinking. Is this the that's the tactful way of putting it. And my response to that is, actually, you do not understand the source material. If you think that's really telling a story of Pride and Prejudice, you do not understand the source material. So in that, that's just one tiny example of nuance is important. So another one that I would use, and this is more a more recent thing, is context is really important along with the nuance. So the nuance of the context. So I don't want to really get into the big age debate thing, but I will say that I don't think an age gap is necessarily a barrier between two characters having an equal relationship. Let's take the Immortals series by Tamora Pierce, for example. You start off with Dana, the main character, being she's 13 in the first book. And her her teacher, the person who becomes her teacher, is something like 23, 24. But they form a really strong friendship as well. Dana's an incredibly powerful mage. She just doesn't know it yet. And Noumea, who her teacher, also incredibly powerful mage. They spend the next sort of 4 years working together. And gradually she goes past the point where she needs him as a teacher anymore. And they just kind of become partners. You know, they're a unit that work together during this big war that Tortle is having with Karthak. And they eventually, you know, he realizes he's fallen in love with his student, and it's really, you know, for him it's very, very awkward, because he's kind of like, I'm in a position of power and I feel like this about her and I can't do anything about it. And he keeps trying to push her away. And finally she confronts him with it and says, I think you're being really stupid. If we both love each other, then it doesn't matter. They do actually have a really serious conversation about it. He says, you know, it's a really base trick for an experienced man to make a young and inexperienced girl believe she's in love with him in order to get what he wants out of her. And then she turns it around and says, well, you know, you could turn that around and it would be quite easy for me to seduce you. And then one morning you'd wake up and realise you want a mature woman, and instead you'd have, you know, effectively a baby, a child. So they back off from each other a little bit. And then much, much later, towards the end of the series, he you know, they've literally gone through the war. Both of them have nearly died multiple times and they've been separated. And when he finally finds her on the battlefield, he literally just goes, look, just marry me. And she's like, I'll think about it if you ask me again in a year's time. It's not even a definite yes. It's a, I'll think about it. It's really very obviously, even though he did start out as her teacher, it's really obviously a balanced and equal relationship where he respects her and she respects him, and neither of them are trying to push the other one into anything. And I think in the end, they choose not to get married at all. They just live together and they decide to have children together in much, much later books. But it's very definitely not, oh, male teacher gets off with his student, which I've seen it described as. So I think that's one area where the nuance thing really does bug me.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Yeah, the other example is a more recent one. Obviously, Stephanie Meyer's version of Twilight from Edward's point of view, Midnight Sun, has recently come out. It was a lot of fun. I enjoyed it. I think it kind of, for me, it kind of answers the question about what this 100-year-old being would see in a 17-year-old girl. And the thing is, in many ways, he's frozen at 17. So my entire theory about the reason Bella's being so obsessed with being made into a vampire is the fact she knows that she's going to outgrow him and she's not going to feel like a teenager in love forever is actually correct. But I've seen other people reading it and saying, well, no, I thought Edward was frozen at 17, but here he reads like an actual man. And I'm like, have you read Bella's perspective? Because she sounds like she's about 30. You know? And I would argue that, yes, that relationship starts off as very unequal. I mean, for a start, he wants to kill her to start with. It's not an equal relationship. But by the end of the fourth book, it's very much an equal relationship, and she's even the one calling the shots. So things can change over time. I really hate this attitude of, oh my god, there's more than 2 years age gap, then, you know, that person clearly has the power. It's not true. It's more nuanced than that. And once again, this hits my I really pity you of people who just want an easy answer. Seriously, it really bugs me.
I do think, you know, as you say, nuance does come into it, and it really is about the individual. I can understand a lot of the objections because, you know, the reality is that usually when there is a significant age difference or a significant, you know, position of power, there have been so many people who have abused that, who really have abused that in reality. And there was a time when there was this great sense where it was romanticised, to the point that, you know, a lot of people did get hurt. So I can really understand this sort of knee-jerk reaction of everybody going, it's bad, it's not good to romanticise this. And I tend to agree with it, it's not good to romanticise it. However, if you are telling a story, you do have to consider the individual as well. You have to consider the individual, the kind of story that's being told, and you do have to consider the nuance. There's so many ways that it can be written badly, and on those occasions, it's very easy to mark that out and say, no, this is not a good relationship. It's very clear that the author has not thought about this at all. But very clearly in the Tamora Pierce one, this has been thought about, because the two characters are talking about it. And the fact of the matter is that you can have a successful relationship between two people who have an age gap of more than 2 years. It's more than possible. And relationships between two people can also change as time goes on. But it really does depend on the individual. And I think that a lot of people in the fiction world have done it badly, very badly, and I can completely, and I share that sense of disgust. But I also think that it can be done absolutely very well, too. For instance, I never really see that many people complaining about Emma.
Yeah.
Emma and Mr. Knightley. And that was one which always made me feel a bit weird.
Well, the thing is, if you read Emma, and admittedly it's most people's not favourite Jane Austen book, Emma's about the Enclosure Act, and it's about not really having very many choices.
Yeah.
At the same time, the whole Emma and Mr. Knightley thing, I feel like the whole time Jane Austen is pointing a finger at it, saying, this is not good, people, look at this, you all think it's normal, but it's really not. And I think she deliberately made it quite icky when he, you know, he actually says, I held you in my arms when you were a baby, when you were first born. And I'm like, ew, you know,
yeah.
That's not good. And the fact that he scolds her all the way through the book as well. And a lot of people seem to twist that into, no, she just needed someone older and wiser to tell her what to do. And I'm like, ooh, that's bad territory already, you know.
Yeah, because that's the thing, is that it's not that their relationship developed over time. He still babies her. He still treats her like someone who needs instruction from someone who's older. It is not a partnership of equals, in the least.
No.
And that's kind of what makes me feel a bit funny about the whole thing.
I mean, in fairness, he's about the only person of sufficient wealth and class who could actually challenge her, because in any other marriage, she would probably be the more dominant party. So there is that. On the other hand, the Women's Property Act didn't turn up until around 1876, which is a good 100 years after this. So, well, not quite so much. But, you know, so all her property becomes his. He agrees to live at her home while her father is alive. But what he's actually done is his estate is adjunct to theirs. So he's actually increased his estate. Also, he's the one who's been enclosing all the fields. So you have the Romanys who no longer have commons to stay on, and the villagers are hungry. It's all this nuance. Again, nuance matters. All this nuance stuff is happening in Emma, and everyone thinks it's a light romantic comedy, and it's bloody well not.
No. It's actually got a very claustrophobic feel to it, doesn't it?
Definitely. So, that's why I suppose I get annoyed with the whole, oh, but this is such a great film. This is a great version of it. There's this matchmaking 21-year-old. And I'm like, if that is genuinely all you took away from reading Emma, then you should not be making a film of it, because you're not qualified.
It also makes me think of
Trudy Canavan's series, the Black Magician trilogy, where spoilers if you haven't read the whole series, but Sonya and Acheron end up in a relationship with each other. Now, technically, there is a massive power difference between them right at the beginning of the series. He's the High Lord, she's a student. He then sort of takes her on as his apprentice. And, you know, he is teaching her. But the emotional relationship they have with each other is very different. And this is the bit that kind of, this is where it changes, in that it's not just about the position of, right, I happen to be teaching you this particular thing. Because that doesn't necessarily mean that someone is, you know, that there's a gap emotionally. If Jules, as she has done, has sat me down and taught me something, we don't sort of, I don't suddenly feel like, oh God, you know, she's my massively emotional superior. No, we approach the table as equals. But she happens to have a particular, she happens to have a lot of knowledge that I don't have. And she teaches me and instructs me in all sorts of ways. That doesn't mean, therefore, that actually when it comes to other aspects that we're not equals. And that's one thing I liked about the Black Magician trilogy, is that Acheron is teaching Sonya a lot of things. But when it comes to their mentality, when it comes to the way that they are, you know, that they speak and exchange, it's very much a thing of equals. She's not in a position of power, but she's not powerless. She is very much kind of pushing against it. And as they sort of become equals, he falls in love with her first and doesn't actually, you know, approach on that at all. She is the one who ends up sort of pursuing him. And I liked their relationship. It felt like a strong and good relationship. And it felt realistic. But if it had been done slightly differently, you know, if he had been sort of schooling her in all aspects of life, it would have started to feel a bit weird. Also within the context, he was about, God, I think he was nearing his 30s. And
I think he was about 30, because he might have been slightly over it, because wasn't he the same age as Sonya's old master, kind of thing?
Oh, no. Her old master was...
No, so her old master's son. So he would have been late 20s to early 30s.
Yeah.
They came up together, basically.
So that's about right. So yeah, he's about 30, and Sonya is kind of, God, I don't.
She's 19.
Yeah, she is. She's 19 or something like that. Towards the end of the series, so you know, there's an 11-year age gap there. But it would be very different, I think, if you know, it had started when she was 14. And I also think that it's just, there's the nuance as well, in that she comes from a society where that is not a significant age gap for marriage, particularly during that era where you want an older man because he needed to be experienced, he needed to have money and security and things like that, and you wanted a younger woman because of, you know, the whole baby thing. In society, you know, a sort of a 30-year-old marrying a 20-year-old would not have been that weird. They wouldn't have really thought of it like that at all.
That would have been nothing, to be quite honest. Yeah. That age, sort of age gap. To be honest, that would have been nothing of an age gap in Victorian England. So people, that's again why the nuance actually really does matter. The other thing to think about, I think, with Sonya and Acheron is the fact that Acheron is really damaged. He has been tortured and enslaved and has never been able to tell anyone about it because it led to him learning forbidden magic, which he cannot tell anyone about.
Yeah.
He accepted the position of High Lord as much to guard everybody else as also to keep his own secret. And again, he doesn't just have Sonya killed or expelled or anything. He takes her under his wing so that he can keep an eye on her. Yeah. So he's trying to do the best he can with the choices he's got. Sonya makes her own choices. She chooses to learn black magic.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the thing is, she's grown up more or less on the streets. I think that's the other thing. It's the thing with the Immortals series is that you start the first book, and obviously Dana's 13, and she's just seen her entire family murdered.
Yeah.
As in, she was away from the farm one night. When she gets back, she realises raiders have come through, and they have brutally murdered everyone. Her mother, her grandfather, all the animals.
Mm-hmm.
For a while, she actually lives with a pack of wolves, and then the villagers start to get panicky about witchcraft and start hunting her. So, you know, she's been through so much that by the time you meet her on the first page, she's not a child anymore.
No.
Because she's had to pull all that behind you. I think people don't really take into account the fact that your life experiences shape you, and some people have the luxury of staying children and teenagers far longer than other people do.
Yeah. For instance, I think, you know, age is a very good, you know, kind of guideline, but it is a guideline. And obviously there are, you know, the whole sort of, there's the physical, there's the chemical side of things as well, which must be taken into account. Absolutely. You know, you really, things don't start to settle down in your brain until you're about sort of 25. So, you know, without a shadow of a doubt, these things are real and need to be taken into consideration. And, you know, all physical sides of things need to be taken into consideration. But it is very possible to have a character who is, you know, 21, who's in a relationship with someone who is also 21, and for it to be a completely imbalanced relationship, for it to be, for one character to be emotionally, you know, very, very young, to still be very naive, to still be, you know, basically a child, and for the other one to actually be an adult, really. It is possible to do that as well, just as it's possible to have someone who's 19 years old who really has developed to some, you know, to be much, much more mature and is able to very happily date someone who's, you know, 21.
Or much older.
Or much even. Older. Again, I get a bit funny about the whole age difference thing, for very personal reasons. For the most part, I really am, you know, I'm very cautious around it, and I do think that it has been portrayed so badly in so much, and romanticised in very unhealthy ways. But I do think that nuance does matter, and it does depend on the story, and it does depend how the author approaches it and whether they do it appropriately or not.
Definitely. I completely agree with that. And you're right, it has been portrayed in a really bad way. And a lot of it is the fact that fantasy in particular tends to rather lazily grasp this quasi-medieval version of the world where, as you say, older men were more stable in terms of income and having a place to live, and younger women were more fertile and therefore more desirable if you wanted to continue a dynasty.
Yeah.
And it's taken it and it's never really explored why it's doing this. It's just portrayed it as that's the desirable, that's the desirable status quo, when in fact it doesn't have to be like that at all. You're writing fantasy, you can make whatever age gap you want work, really, as long as you can sit down and tell us what it works.
Yeah, absolutely. And it really does depend on the individual, but the weird romanticization between like someone who's a teacher and someone who's a pupil, as I said, it's fine, you can have a partnership of equals where one of them happens to be teaching the other something, or one of them happens to be instructing them. That is possible. But if you are writing something where emotionally there, you know, there's lots of scolding and there isn't, it's not equal intellectually, you know, things like that, where one is definitely leading the other, that's when I start to get really freaked out.
Yeah.
And I see it all the time, and it really, really disgusts me. Like, it actually makes my skin crawl.
I have to say, I've seen more of it where there isn't an age gap at all. Mm. And this happens particularly in young adult fiction. And what they seem to be doing is you have a, you know, maybe a 1 year age gap where, and it's almost always male female as well. So it's a male female romantic pairing. And the male is always sort of like a bit snarky, a bit dismissive, a bit putting the girl down. Well, secretly, that's because he really loves her kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then instead of exploring and saying, actually, this person has issues, and the girl then rejects him.
Yeah.
Which is something I did, in fairness. They roll into it, and they roll into the whole, yes, but she can make his life better thing. And that bugs me, because that is still a prevalent thing in young adult fantasy.
Yeah, absolutely. And also the other thing in young adult fantasy, which they kind of do, because the weird thing is that there is this weird romanticization of, you know, like the more mature guy, whereby the way they do it, they're like, well, he just happens to be a very mature character. And I'm like, that's fine, except we just still keep seeing this thing where he's kind of leading her through everything, and it's not equal. And I'm just there like, 50 Shades of Grey, for instance, that is not a relationship of equals.
No. And I feel really bad for Stephanie Meyer, actually, because she almost gets blamed for 50 Shades of Grey.
Yeah.
When she didn't actually write anything that was anything like that.
No, she really
and she
didn't.
She actually explored a relationship going from very unequal to a place of equality at the end. Mm. Whereas 50 Shades of Grey was just kind of like, oh no, this is titillation with no characterization whatsoever, and a very, very disturbing male character.
Yeah.
So, you know, bullshit. Actually, Alan and I were discussing this, and Alan said, I don't know why Stephanie Meyer just didn't sue the arse off of E.L. James, because it's really apparent that that's what was going on.
Yeah.
Anyway, moving on to other things. So that's my big hot take on one thing, and it feeds into lots of different things, and that is that nuance is important.
Yeah.
You can't just go, well, I like this version. Well, absolutely, you can go, I like this version. But you're not really being analytical, and don't tell me you are if you're not willing to engage with questioning it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Sorry.
I'm glad I started with a light subject there, so
yeah, we went started off with something, so it was like, yeah, nuance matters, suddenly like, let's talk about age gaps in fiction. Well, mine is considerably light in response, actually. And that is the idea that when it comes to adapting speculative fiction, live action is seen as superior to animation.
Yeah, oh my god, the Disney thing as well.
Yeah.
I nearly wrote that down. That was going to be my hot take, that the Disney live action things are basically unnecessary money grabbers.
Yeah, and to reassert their, you know,
their copyright.
Yeah, their copyright. Absolutely. And it's something which really bothers me, because animation is still seen as something which is exclusively for children, even though we now have like a lot of adult cartoons and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I just think that there are so many things which actually would work even better as animation than they do in the live action, particularly as films and as TV series go on and stuff like that. Recently, you know, they're just redoing a live action version of Avatar: The Last Airbender, and all I can think of is, why? Why do you need a live action version? You cut Korra, you know, and there was all sorts of problems with Korra, which caused problems with the storytelling and just in general. They did that, and now they're like, oh, we'll make a live action one. And then, because of creative differences, originally they had hired the two people who were behind the animated version, and now they've both left because of creative differences. And all I can think of is, why are you making it?
It's not necessary.
It really isn't necessary. The first series is so good, and I think they're just there like, oh, people will prefer this. More people will watch it. And I just, it really annoys me. It really does annoy me that they do that. And there are so many things where all I can think of is that actually this would just work so much better as an animated series. You know, I know Harry Potter isn't everybody's favourite thing right now, but the original series would actually work so much better as a series of cartoons.
Yeah.
I think it would just, it would look amazing if it were that. There are so many things that I read, and then I sort of see them the way they've tried to adapt it to the film screen. And I just think, it's kind of lost something. And people are like, oh, you know, it's got to be live action. You've got to have all of the, you know, the bells and whistles and all the special effects. And I just think, but you know, if you just have a visually spectacular animation, that's okay too. And there are things you can do with animation that can actually sort of come off much better than doing them on screen.
Big time.
Big time. Not least because of the way that you can get actors. You can get pretty much any actor if it's animated. You can get the right voice and the right thing.
And they look right because you've drawn them.
Exactly. And it's just...
It's like, imagine trying to do a live-action Castlevania. Yeah. I honestly don't think that would work now. And Stephanie Meyer said about an interview with Midnight Sun. I'm such a nerd, I actually read all these interviews and things. But you know what? Fucking bite me. It's my candy, okay? This is what I like to read when I want a break. Mm. Yeah, she was saying about Midnight Sun, someone said, oh, is there any likelihood of a film? And she said, well, you know, film rights are always a possibility. And then she said, I'd prefer to see it as an animated feature film or feature series because no one really looks like the vampires that she has in her head.
Yeah.
And she said, I think it would be amazing and, you know, you could actually gear it towards a more adult audience if you did it in animation. And I'm like, I can see that because you can imagine a sort of vaguely Castlevania-esque type style and you just make the vampires just that bit more inhuman.
Yeah. I
rather than people
agree.
In makeup.
Yeah, and also it would just mean like the whole sparkling thing, for instance.
Yeah.
They couldn't do it properly, I don't think, because
no. It's supposed to look like someone's almost on fire, as in you go, oh my god, what's happened to them? Have they burst into flames? And then you realise that they're just refracting light.
Yeah. Like I almost always thought of it like as if they were actually almost like made of diamond.
Yeah.
That there was just, and it was just the way that it was shimmering and stuff like that, like they were almost see-through. And they couldn't really do that properly. I mean, the problem with the live action was he just looks hella sweaty. just the light sparkling off of him. He just looks like he's taken a dip.
I have to say, I've recently rewatched Twilight and New Moon, not out of my choice. This has been Alan's Friday night film choice because he wanted some vampires and for some reason he went for Twilight and I'm like, okay, fine. So I watched it and I was sat there watching it thinking, well, it's the nuance thing once again, and I won't reopen that can of worms, but it was just kind of like, these are, you know, they're okay, but I think the films get progressively worse.
Yeah, I think the first film was probably the closest.
They've removed dialogue. They've no wonder people think that Bella has no personality and she's really stupid, and that basically Edward's this powerful immortal being who's come along and fallen in love with the first six-piece chicken McNobody to call him a bitch. You know, I mean, which is not what's happened at all. But there's no nuance, and you know they've taken away all Bella's snarkiness and her funniness, and
yeah. Yeah.
So anyway, it's really noticeable having sort of read a book recently and then watched it. Alan was just sort of really enjoying it. So, oh yeah, this is a nice Friday night film. I don't have to think kind of thing.
Fantastic.
So there you go.
But yeah, the snobbery against animation, it's slowly easing up. But I just do think that, for instance, what, you know, I think about if any of the stuff that I wrote ever got sort of made, you know, got film rights, particularly my children's books, all I can think of is they would just look so much better as animation.
Yeah. Do you know, it reminds me, and I agree with that, I think you're absolutely right, and having seen all the Studio Ghibli type stuff as well, yeah, that'd be perfect.
Yeah.
But it just reminds me of being a child, and my dad used to record selections of 80s cartoons, which are not great now if you look at them, but 80s cartoons, which were the best we had at the time, okay, on an old VCR cassette so that Sarah and I could watch them in the mornings on Saturday. So he and Mum would get a lie-in and we'd go downstairs, because typical children don't want to get up on a school day, but on a non-school day we're up at 6 a.m. And we'd entertain ourselves for a couple of hours perfectly happily watching this. And if Dad ever happened to be passing by, he'd get hooked by the television. So I think there's, you know, I feel kind of sorry, because obviously his own childhood, there was a complete dearth of animated children's programs at all, to be honest.
Yeah.
And it, you know, even now, you can see him when we've gone round to see one of my sisters and either my niece and my nephew, and they've put a film on in the background for the kids, and Dad's, you're trying to get him to conversation, but there's an animated film on and Dad's been drawn into it. I don't blame it. I get it. I really, really get it. There should be more stuff like that for adults.
My brother, and I feel okay saying this because he actually he announced it on Twitter, but on his Netflix, he has one option. You know, they have them, and then so as not to mess up their algorithm, they have a fake child. They have a fake child who happens to watch a lot of anime, and the thing I laugh about is that they're watching anime like Full Metal Alchemist. I'm like, a young child should not be watching Full Metal Alchemist.
Oh my god, no. Or Evangelion or anything like, yeah, that, to be honest, because my god, Evangelion's bleak. Oh, the original series,
it really is, yeah.
Okay, right, my next one. Yeah, okay, I'm not going to pull any punches with this. Hate reading as a pointless waste of time. And I don't get it. I don't get why anyone would spend their time reading something they know they're going to dislike just so that they can live tweet bitchy comments about it and spread more negativity into the world.
Yeah.
And then they dress up this mean girl behaviour. And let's face it, that's what it is. This is people acting like mean girl teenagers at school, but thinking it's okay because they're dressing it up as analytics.
Right.
And yeah, it's not.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I'm all for letting people be honest about,
yeah,
a book. I'm all for letting people just say, actually, I really didn't enjoy that. I say recently, a few years ago, I read a book which I could see objectively that it was good, and so I recommended it. I actually gave it quite a high review on Goodreads, but my actual review itself basically listed all the things that I disliked about it. And they were very personal reasons that I disliked. I just couldn't get on with the main character. I found her really annoying. But, you know, objectively, I said, objectively, this is a fantastic book. It just didn't quite hit it for me, but I'm going to give it a high rating because I think it deserves one. And I have also given things low ratings, but what I tend to do is, particularly if it's, you know, a debut author, or it's someone who's starting out, or it's not one of these really, really big high hitters, you know, who are just absolutely doing fine. If I am not enjoying a book, I just tend to stop reading it.
Yeah, I know, it's like quid pro quo, isn't it? It's like, I could keep reading it and hating it, or I could put it down.
Yeah.
I mean, I will admit, I am guilty of being one of these people who absolutely has to finish. So if I've DNF'd something, I'm usually pretty pissed off.
Yeah.
Because I hate not finishing things. It's like, Alan will say, I want to watch a bit of this film and then a bit of that film, and he can be a bit pick and mix like that.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I know, no, that's not what we do. We pick a film and we watch it from beginning to end. I'm sorry, I can't do this, watching a scene here, watching a scene there. I can't be doing with it. And I realise that this is a problem for me personally, and not everybody has to act like I do. It's the same with books. If I start it, then I might go, I'm not feeling this right now, but I know I'm going to come back to it later, so I'll put it down. But a genuine DNF, I'm not going to pick it up again, is really tough for me.
Yeah.
So I try to just go, you know what, this book isn't for me, DNF it, put it down. And yeah, there was one recently which on paper had everything in it that I should have liked. And I got 4 or 5 chapters in and I was so bored. And I just, the style was not captivating me and I didn't care about any of the characters. It got to the point where I could not remember the character names in the sense of I was mixing them all up.
Yeah.
Regardless of gender. And I just thought, this is stupid. I could push myself through and finish it and I will have a vague memory of having read it. Or I could just go, you know what, this book just isn't for me. So DNF it, and I didn't give it a rating.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely understand. With me, I'm just, that's it. If I'm not interested, I might pick it up again later. But I'm pretty exclusive with my time. I don't read as fast as you, for one. but also, what I tend to do is I will not pick up a book or start a movie which I don't think I'm going to enjoy.
Yes.
Certainly, well, if someone has said, you know, read this, you'll hate it, I'm not going to do it. If, you know, if it's a matter of, you know, look at this scene, I might read a scene or stuff like that to get kind of get an example and maybe have a little laugh at it or you know, really not engage with it. But at no point have I ever decided, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to sit down and read a book that I'm actually genuinely going to hate and I'm just going to bitch about it. That being said, I have laughed at people doing live readings of 50 Shades of Grey and leaving comments. Not gonna lie, that was actually quite funny.
I have to say, yeah, but I'm not going to you know, I've done the same thing because it was funny. I have to say, I got assigned 50 Shades of Grey to read as part of a training thing at the library, and I read it and. No, I got assigned the entire trilogy. It was all in one book.
Oh, no.
I finally DNF'd midway through the third book because it lost even the vague interest it had at the beginning. Yeah, I mean, Anastasia is basically one of your most dumb-as-a-box-of-rocks characters ever. Seriously, seriously stupid. Someone turns up in the hardware store you work in, buys lengths of rope and chain and cable ties and looks at you with twinkling eyes and you don't know what the fuck he's doing with them. Anyway, moving on from that. So yes, but the one thing you can say is that that had such a huge audience drowning out the people who didn't like the book, and it made so much money for the author that, you know, it might have been unpleasant, but she could have just walked away from those comments.
Yeah.
This is not the same as, let's say, Amelie Wen Zhao, who, you know, had blood air coming out, and there were two particular authors who were less successful on Twitter sort of decrying the book, and then people started decrying it, and you know, she's a debut author and she obviously had a good deal. We've been through all of this.
Yeah.
It's a different kettle of fish. That was punching down, that wasn't punching up. You know, I'm not saying it either way. With the 50 Shades of Grey thing, you know what, I did review it and I found something positive to say about it as well. I hate those books. Genuinely. No, I don't hate them because that would require effort. I'm indifferent to their existence.
Oh!
But I can see why someone else would find them to be compelling pieces of escapism. So you know what? You don't at me about Twilight and I won't at you about 50 Shades of Grey.
Yeah.
But yeah. And I do write negative reviews, or scathing reviews, as Madeline puts it. But
oh, so scathing.
But every single fair. Scathing review I've ever written, I've also found something positive to say about the book.
Yes. I would say that your reviews are very fair. One thing that really gets me is that I just think that if you happen not to have enjoyed a book or a film, don't abuse people who have enjoyed it.
Yeah, there's a lot of that.
There is a lot of that.
The time I wrote a review about Raising Steam by Terry Pratchett, and obviously Terry Pratchett had dementia at the time.
Yeah.
Obviously he's dead now. And I loved it. And Moist von Lipwig is not very many people's favourite character, but he's one of my favourites. And I just really enjoyed the book, and I loved the little cameos of the others. So I wrote this really enthusiastic review. And then a few days later, this bloke pops up on Amazon and told me why I was... basically listed the reasons why I was wrong and I was too stupid to understand real Pratchett. It was hilarious.
So,
don't do that. That's a dig move, guys. You might think that, but think that and say it to your friend. You know, sometimes I genuinely think people are too stupid to read books, but I tend to tell Madeline. I don't tell the entire world.
I think it's also the other thing is that you can disagree with people, and it's okay to sort of like say, you know, to start a discussion with someone, but also consider actually not everyone wants to discuss it with you. Are you in the appropriate place to be discussing things? Are you actually approaching it as a discussion, or are you approaching it as an attack? And I completely understand how people can feel strongly about things like that. Okay, so this it's not quite the same thing, but you know the whole pairing things. You know, sometimes people, you know, feel very strongly about their OTP, their one true pairing.
Yeah.
And, you know, they feel incredibly strongly about it. And I've never really understood that, because I've always been sort of like, fine. If I happen to think these two should go well together, then that's great. But if you happen to think two other characters go well together, great as well. And I was totally fine with it until one time it came, it was for A Court of Thorns and Roses, actually, with people pairing Elaine and Azrael. And for some reason, I've just gotten so annoyed with it. I really hate it. I'm just there like, please let me have my Lucian and Elaine. Let me just have that, please. And the only time it's acceptable is if Lucian gets to be happy elsewhere. But to be honest, it's one of those things. And I've seen people, though, getting really angry and really snappy with one another about it and being genuinely unpleasant. And it's, you know, it's the first time I've ever actually felt very strongly about it, to the point where I get annoyed when I see it, you know, other people talking about how Elaine and Azrael are a perfect pair. And I'm like, oh, no, they're not. I really hate that. It's weird and etc. But I don't go onto their thing and just be like, you're wrong and you're stupid because of X, Y, and Z. I go, it's a piece of fiction. They see things differently. To be honest, I can understand why they actually pair these two. Some of the headcanons are actually quite nice. I totally get it. As is your favourite character, you want him to be happy? Wonderful. Brilliant. I'm just going to let you be happy over there. And I'm going to be happy over here. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, it's like you have your experience of that piece of fiction and I'll have mine, and we don't have to talk about it. It's fine, we can disagree.
Yeah.
It's not a case of it's very Gulliver's Travels, isn't it, where, you know, the Lilliputians are going to war with this other race because they open their boiled eggs the wrong way up.
Yeah.
It's literally that stupid.
Yeah.
Okay, well, since you talked about pairings, I will just briefly mention that this is my hot take on one thing, and I know it seems to be an increasingly unpopular opinion, but I'm sticking by this one. I think the pairings in Harry Potter were right.
Yeah,
those worked for me. And you know, we've talked about it before, but I think people go far too much about from the film portrayal of things, which took a lot out of, say, Ron's character, etc.
Yeah, and gave it all to Hermione.
And gave it all to Hermione, so he was just like the comic relief. And it was almost like, you know, it was like a charity thing that she ended up with him, rather than, no, they've been building to this for like 7 books.
Yeah, and there was actually respect between them.
Yeah.
And that the one line that always annoys me is in the film at one point where they're dueling, he goes, I'll go easy on you. Ron Book would never say that. Ron Book would just be like, right, I am ready for this because she is going to come at me hard. Ron Book knows how powerful and vicious Hermione can be. It just really annoyed me because I thought, that's so out of character. It's just because there is no existence where Ron Ron, who's always felt inferior his entire life, that's a whole point of his character, is that he's felt inferior to everybody around him, turning around to saying to the person that he considers to be the smartest person in their year, the smartest witch he knows, and saying, I'll go easy on you, please.
It's not going to happen. The thing is, Ron is quite often the voice of reason as well. So, and I suppose the other thing that I hated about the films was the fact that they took all of Ginny's character away. So instead of this badass person who dates lots of different people and is considered really cool and attractive and is very, you know, it's quite clever in her own right and quite talented in her own right and goes on to play for the Holyhead Harpies. Yeah. And she's kind of like this, oh, I love you, Harry. And then finally she's 16 and old enough for him to look at, kind of thing. It just comes off so wrong.
It really does. They did remove a lot of her characterisation. They did remove a lot of the fact that, you know, and she does talk back to him. I particularly like the line, is like, well, you know, you could have come and spoken to me as the only other person who knows what it feels like to be possessed by Voldemort. You know, and Harry's just there like, I completely forgot. She goes, good for you. And I thought, hell yeah.
Yeah, good for you as well. Because sometimes Harry needs to be slapped.
He does.
Properly. So, it, you know, it, the way it was written, it worked. Okay. So, do you have another one?
Yes, okay. Now, this is pretty personal to me, but it's something that I've been getting increasingly annoyed about, and that is the Bad Boys Endgame.
Yes, I see that a lot, and do you know what? Okay, you've just reminded me of another thing I didn't write down, but I'm like, you know what? I am all for the nice guy finishing first. I am all for the guy who is perhaps not 100% confident and maybe is a bit gawky and unlikely, but he's kind and he's intelligent and he's generally a decent person. You know what? Let's hear it for that guy.
And this is the thing, like, I don't mind the bad boy in a series. I really don't mind the bad boy. It's just that increasingly the bad boy has gone less from, okay, I'm a bit rough around the edges and maybe I'm not always very nice, to literal torturer and murderer. And that, maybe I'm talking about Star Wars, but and again, I think Jules is going to disagree with me on this, and I think a few other people are going to disagree with me on this.
What, are we talking about Kylo Ren?
Now,
no, Kylo Ren's a whiny little bitch.
Yeah,
don't like
exactly.
Him.
I don't like him. To be honest, I never really understood the relationship between him and Rey. Again,
there is no relationship. They're like the cosmic twins, which would have been an interesting direction to take in. I'm sorry, I keep interrupting you because I've now got really annoyed. I'm going to shut up.
Okay, well, I'm glad we agree on that. But yeah, Kylo Ren, he just really annoyed me. He's whiny, and like in the first one I kind of liked it because it was, the whole point is that he was just, I just thought, yeah, he's the bad guy. But then the way they kind of tried to turn it around and stuff like that, and again, there are going to be some people who disagree with me, some people are going to be like, no, absolutely, we liked that pairing, we were waiting for that pairing, and that's fair enough. I'm really tired of it. I'm really, really tired of it, because I just think It's okay to have the pairing with the bad boy. That's okay as well. But the fact of the matter is that it's all the time. And what would have been actually quite nice is if it had been oh god, I don't even remember what her name is. The main character.
In Star Wars.
Yeah.
You mean Rey?
The new one. Yeah, Rey. Sorry, I can't believe I just forgotten what.
It's like you literally just said her name, so I thought she can't possibly mean Rey.
I did mean Rey. It was literally just flew out of my head. But you know, Rey and Poe.
Yeah.
That would have actually been quite an interesting pairing. Or, particularly, you know, the two of them going through something together, kind of figuring it out together. I quite liked that.
Or Poe and the other. You know what? Ray, Poe, and what's his face? All in a all in a polyamorous relationship together. Because that's how I read that hug at the end. Nobody can take that away from me.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You are completely right. That is exactly how I read that hug at the end as well. It's just and I particularly liked Poe, and I'm pretty sure the actor for the guy who was playing Finn was like 100%, yep, he is in love with Poe. And let's not lie, that's exactly what was happening.
And maybe you know, Finn has like a little side thing with Rose as well, because they took that away in the last film as well. It's really, really annoying. I don't know. It would have made far more sense for Kylo Ren to be more like of a brother balance, you know, balance of scales, like a yin-yang type character for Rey.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's going to feed into another one that I really, really dislike, but I'll talk about that later. But yeah, the whole bad boy thing, it just annoys me. And again, I don't mind a good bad boy character. In fact, I like a good bad boy character. But I think the way that it's been portrayed increasingly has just annoyed me. And I also think that we're steering back into that whole idea, which we'd gone away from and now we're going back to, of the whole sort of, you can be, I can redeem you with my love.
Yeah.
And it just, I'm just, but then at the same time, and on the same part of this, you have the bad boy character, and this is going to sound like I'm completely contradicting myself, but you have the bad boy character who is actually really just 100% a good person.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at you, Reese.
Oh god, that was so annoying. That took away, in the end, that took away everything that was interesting about his character. And and retconned it. I think that was the problem. It was retconned. And in order for him to be the good guy, we had to make Tamlin the really bad guy. And it didn't make sense with everything that had happened. So
no,
it rewrote the entire first book, basically.
It did. And this is kind of where I'm at, because it's about balance for me. I'm not, I like a good redemption arc, but a good redemption arc, I think also, and the idea of actually a character, the bad guy isn't necessarily 100% bad, but they should still, you know, have some form of development. It shouldn't just be, well, it was all a lie. Again, Acheron, the whole idea, well, it was all a lie, it was all a mystery. Acheron still did some pretty bad things, and he did have to atone for them.
He did, yeah. I will say that in the newer trilogy, which I know you haven't read, is that right?
No, I haven't.
You do find out that, you know, Acheron had an affair on his way back from, you know, being enslaved and stuff. And there was another child, and, you know, there was all this stuff that obviously he either hadn't had time or hadn't had the intention to ever tell Sonya. And Sonya said herself, well, you know, there are times when I wonder how well I knew your father. But she doesn't say it in a really bitter way. It's just a case of, well, you know what, I've had 20 years to come to terms with all of this and I don't regret anything. But at the same time, you know, you react differently when your back's against a wall and you were in the middle of a literal war. It might have been, you know, it wasn't a fairy tale romance and I'm never going to claim it was, kind of thing.
Yeah. And also, you know, it's not like they really had that much time to explore exactly what they were doing.
No.
You know, they were two people who were finding comfort in the arms of each other whilst they were on the run. And they had feelings for one another, but it's not like they said, right, let's get married, let's settle down, let's move in together. You know, it was a very different kind of relationship. So, yes. The other one, Zuko. Zuko from Avatar The Last Airbender has an amazing redemption arc. But his faults don't just disappear. There's something that he works on, you know, his massive temper. And all of these things which have clearly been brought on by abuse as a child, but and massive trauma. So all of these things are understandable, but he still has to work on them. And that was something with Rhysand as well. In the second book, you got this sense that he had gone through something absolutely terrible. But he was still, he still had that sense of characterization. He still had that sense that I've done bad things and I might do bad things again in order to do that. But it was like in the third book that kind of got taken away and he was just this paragon of goodness.
Yeah.
And there was no room for growth because of that, which annoyed me. And this is, you know, and I'm saying this from the point of view of I actually enjoyed the third book. I think people often forget this. I actually liked the whole series.
Yeah, don't mistake my opinion for Madeline's on this one. We completely disagree on the third book and on A Quarter of Frost and Starlight, and you know that's absolutely fine.
But I can object, you know. I can see your point of view, Jules, and I can agree with it. And yeah, it's the idea that someone just needs to be 100% sort of turned around. Another version of this is Fruits Basket with the character of actually Cure. Now, Cure is a bad boy in the sense that he's very rough with his words. He's actually quite nasty to begin with. He's saying lots of nasty things. He's constantly trying to have a fight. He's very, very angry. And then you basically start to explore his character and start to explore why he's acting like that. And you start to understand it. And he actually changes his behavior very gradually as he starts to deal with his own trauma and his own truth and as he starts to grow. It's not a, well, suddenly actually everything's understandable and now that the main character understands it, all of that bad behavior is gone.
Yeah.
It's not that at all. It's a progressive thing where being shown love and compassion and understanding and a little bit of hope and falling in love is something which is redeeming this character very slowly. But they're not automatically cured of all of the negative things that they've been harboring inside of them. No matter how, you know, understandable those negative qualities are, it's not just immediately gone. So I guess what I'm saying is that I like the bad boy character, but I do think that the way that it's handled needs to be appropriate, and that actually it's okay as well for the love interest to not always be the bad boy, and that it's not automatically less interesting if the person they happen to fall in love with is actually just quite nice.
Yeah. Absolutely. That's one I definitely, well, of, you know, if you read any of my books, you'll know that that's kind of where I end up going anyway.
Exactly. Okay, I'm not saying Kieran and Lucas and this is why I'm angry. but, you know, Lucas was a bit of a dick, to be honest, to begin with. He has a bit of that bad boy vibes, but also in that very classist bad boy vibes. Whereas Kieran is just sort of quite sweet.
Yeah.
But complicated. They're all complicated.
And obviously you've got Nick, who should be a bad boy. You know, he's in a band, he rides a motorcycle, he's a big guy, and he's actually just, he's a marshmallow. He's literally the nicest person alive.
He is. I love Nick, because Nick's just... Because obviously also the events in book one is that there's this whole idea that, you know, he's this very mysterious, and he's just there like, hello! And he's just really sweet. I'm like, Nick, you angel, you sweetheart!
I know, he is an absolute little cinnamon roll. I'd love to... I'm trying to find a way of getting him into my new series more.
Do it!
He just gets mentioned a few times because I don't want to give things away, but, you know, he gets mentioned, put it that way. But I'd love him to actually turn up. Maybe he'll turn up in book six. We'll see.
I think that we are wrapping up on part one of this.
We will say that, you know, we were trying to negotiate in good faith with you here, and we really thought we were going to get our unpopular opinions into one episode, but looks like we've got enough for two episodes.
Yes, so I think we're going to have to come back to this. because it turns out we're actually quite passionate about these things. It turns out we have opinions. before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And Jules, have you got one for us?
Yes, I have. I've recently read Julie Cohen's new book, Spirited. This is technically, it's sort of historical fiction, but there's a ghost story element and a gothic element to it, so I feel comfortable recommending it as speculative fiction. It's it's sort of come in a classic style. So I think we've all kind of seen that sort of mid-Victorian thing where you have a young woman who's just lost her family or her father, in this case it is her father, getting married. In this case, the main character, Viola, is getting married to her childhood sweetheart, Jonah. Jonah was one of her father's wards. And her father was a clergyman. Her father has just died, and she is absolutely sunk in a morass of grief. But it was her father's dearest wish that she marry Jonah, and Jonah's just come back from India, where he did something very heroic in Delhi. And there doesn't see she can't see feel any spark between them. I mean, they agreed before he went off to India that they were going to get married. They couldn't imagine being with anyone else. And I think she really encapsulates it with the line, they got married in mourning. So both characters were wearing the classical black mourning clothes that you would wear in Victorian era, rather than bothering to buy a new wedding gown or anything like that. And it sort of really sets the scene for the entire wedding.
Yeah.
Anyway, things are uncomfortable between them. They get on really well. No one's treating anybody badly, and they move away. They move down to Dorset, which is great because it was kind of like, oh, I know this area, I know all of these places. So I really enjoyed that side of it. And Flora hasn't even been able to bring herself to do the thing that she used to do with her father, which was to take photographs. Obviously, taking photographs in 1853 was very different to taking them now. She's so isolated that in the end she decides to push herself to do it, and Jonah encourages her to, because he says you'll feel close to your father if you do something you used to do together. But meanwhile he's off by himself all the time, and she can't quite work out why. No spoilers, but what happens is you have those two in a place that they don't really know very well, and Viola doesn't really know anybody. And then into the midst of this comes the celebrated medium Henriette Blackthorne, who's a slightly older woman who forms a friendship with Flora. Before she forms this friendship, though, Flora is called out to a farm where one of the young girls is dying, and the farmer is desperate to have a photograph of his girl before she goes, kind of thing. It's like, you can take a photograph, please will you do it for us? And Viola's kind of like, okay, I can do that for you. She takes the photograph, and the photograph shows the daughter, who has literally just died, she's still warm, but next to her in the photograph there's the image of a young girl standing. And this is how Viola finds out that she can photograph spirits, or she seems to be able to, because it happens a few other times. Anyway, she forms a friendship with Henriette, and that's as far as I'm going to tell you what happens, because you have to read the rest of it for yourself. But it's all tangled up with what happened to Jonah in Delhi. And if you remember, there was a big revolt in Delhi where, understandably, the local populace started killing everyone, but very particularly the Christians. This was Black Hole of Calcutta time. And how he escaped and what he was up to there. And it's also to do with Viola finding out why she doesn't really have that spark with Jonah. There is a queer relationship, and there is a multiracial relationship, without giving too much away. It's really, really good. It's an amazingly moving, poignant book, and it's all about grief and loss and redemption and the different kinds of love.
Yeah. Fantastic. I'm going to definitely put that on my list because it just sounds so exciting. Well, thanks very much for listening, guys. We hope that everyone is doing well, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.